to the pot and was eating something, he unceremoniously removed Akemi's head from his knee, shook his fist, and cursed the animal roundly. Beyond the shadow of a doubt, food was more important than a woman's suffering. The next morning, Tanzaimon announced he was going to town with his beggar's bowl. "You stay here while I'm gone," he said. "I have to get some money to buy you medicine, and then we need some rice and oil so we can have something hot to eat." His hat was not a deep one woven of reeds, like those of most itinerant priests, but an ordinary bamboo affair, and his straw sandals, worn and split at the heels, scraped against the ground as he shuffled along. Everything about him, not just his mustache, had an air of scruffiness. Yet, walking scarecrow that he was, it was his habit to go out every day unless it rained. Not having slept well, he was particularly bleary-eyed this morning. Akemi, after crying and carrying on so in the evening, had later sipped her gruel, broken into a heavy sweat, and slept soundly through the rest of the night. He had hardly closed his eyes until dawn. Even walking under the bright morning sun, the cause of his sleeplessness remained with him. He could not get it out of his mind. "She's about the same age as Otsu," he thought, "but they're completely different in temperament. Otsu has grace and refinement, but there's something chilly about her. Akemi's appealing, whether she's laughing, crying, or pouting." The youthful feelings aroused in Tanzaimon's desiccated cells by the strong rays of Akemi's charm had made him all too conscious of his advancing years. And during the night, as he had looked solicitously at her each time she stirred in her sleep, a different warning had sounded in his heart. "What a wretched fool I am! Haven't I learned yet? Though I wear the surplice of the priest and play the shakuhachi of the mendicant, I'm still a long way from achieving the clear and perfect enlightenment of Puhua. Will I never find the wisdom that will release me from this body?" After castigating himself at length, he had forced his sad eyes shut and tried to sleep, but to no avail. As dawn broke, he had again resolved, "I will, I must put evil thoughts behind me." But Akemi was a charming girl. She had suffered so. He must try to comfort her. He had to show her that not all the men in the world were demons of lust. Besides the medicine, he was wondering what sort of present he could bring her when he came back in the evening. Throughout the day's alms-seeking, his spirit would be bolstered by this desire to do something to make Akemi a little happier. That would suffice. He cherished no greater desire. At about the time he recovered his composure and the color returned to his face, he heard the flapping of wings above the cliff beside him. The shadow of a large falcon skimmed past, and Tanzaimon watched a gray feather from a small bird flutter down from an oak branch in the leafless grove above him. Holding the bird in its claws, the falcon rose straight up, exposing the undersides of its wings. Nearby, a man's voice said, "Success!" and the falconer whistled to his bird. Seconds later, Tanzaimon saw two men in hunting outfits coming down the hill behind the Ennenji. The falcon was perched on the left fist of one of them, who carried a net bag for the catch on the side opposite his two swords. An intelligent-looking brown hunting dog trotted along behind. Kojiro stopped and took in the surroundings. "It happened somewhere along here yesterday evening," he was saying. "My monkey was scrapping with the dog, and the dog bit his tail. He hid somewhere and never came out. I wonder if he's up in one of those trees." Seijuro, looking rather disgruntled, sat down on a rock.
"Why would he still be here? He's got legs, too. Anyway, I can't see why you bring a monkey along when you go hunting with falcons."
Kojiro made himself comfortable on the root of a tree. "I didn't bring him, but I can't keep him from tagging along, and I'm so used to him, I miss him when he's not around."
I thought only women and people of leisure like to have monkeys and lapdogs for pets. But I guess I was wrong. It's hard to imagine a student warrior like you being so attached to a monkey.
Having seen Kojiro in action on the dike at Kemma, Seijuro had a healthy respect for his swordsmanship, but his tastes and his general way of life seemed all too boyish. Just living in the same house with him these past few days had convinced Seijuro that maturity came only with age. While he found it difficult to respect Kojiro as a person, this, in a way, made it easier to associate with him. Kojiro replied laughingly, "It's because I'm so young. One of these days I'll learn to like women, and then I'll probably forget all about the monkey." Kojiro chatted idly in a light vein, but Seijuro's face seemed increasingly preoccupied. There was a nervous look in his eyes not unlike that of the falcon perched on his hand. All at once he said irritably, "What's that beggar priest over there doing? He's been standing there staring at us ever since we got here." Seijuro glared suspiciously at Tanzaimon, and Kojiro turned around to have a look. Tanzaimon turned his back and trudged off. Seijuro stood up abruptly.
"Kojiro," he said, "I want to go home. Any way you look at it, this is no time to be out hunting. It's already the 29th of the month."
Laughing with a touch of scorn, Kojiro said,
"We came out to hunt, didn't we? We've only got one turtle dove and a couple of thrushes to show for it. We should try farther up the hill."
"No, let's call it a day. I don't feel like hunting, and when I don't feel like it, the falcon doesn't fly right. Let's go back to the house and practice."
He added, as though talking to himself,
"That's what I need to do. Practice."
"Well, if you must go back, I'll go with you."
He walked along beside Seijuro, but did not seem very happy about it.
"I guess I was wrong to suggest it."
"Suggest what?"
"Going hunting yesterday and today."
"Don't worry about it. I know you meant well. It's just that it's the end of the year, and the showdown with Musashi is creeping up on us fast."
"That's why I thought it'd be good for you to do some hunting. You could relax, get yourself into the proper spirit. I guess you're not the type who can do that."
The more I hear about Musashi, the more I think it's just as well not to underrate him."
"Isn't that all the more reason to avoid getting excited or panicky? You should discipline your spirit."
"I'm not panicky. The first lesson in the art of war is not to make light of your enemy, and I think it's only common sense to try to get in plenty of practice before the fight. If I should lose, then at least I'd know I'd done my best. If the man's better than I am, well..."
Though he appreciated Seijuro's honesty, Kojiro sensed in him a smallness of spirit that would make it very difficult for Seijuro to uphold the reputation of the Yoshioka school. Because Seijuro lacked the personal vision needed to follow in his father's footsteps and run the huge school properly, Kojiro felt sorry for him. In his opinion, the younger brother, Denshichiro, had more strength of character, but Denshichiro was also an incorrigible playboy. And though he was a more capable swordsman than Seijuro, he had no stake in the Yoshioka name. Kojiro wanted Seijuro to forget about the impending bout with Musashi, for this, he believed, would be the best possible preparation for him. The question he wanted to ask, but didn't, was what could he hope to learn between now and the time for the match? "Well," he thought with resignation, "that's the way he is, so I suppose I can't be of much help to him." The dog had run off and was barking ferociously in the distance.
"That means he's found some game," said Kojiro, his eyes brightening.
"Let him go. He'll catch up with us later."
"I'll go have a look. You wait here."
Kojiro sprinted off in the direction of the barking and, after a minute or two, spotted the dog on the veranda of an ancient ramshackle temple. The animal leaped against the dilapidated grill door and fell back. After a few trials, he began scratching at the worn, red-lacquered posts and walls of the building. Wondering what he could possibly be so excited about, Kojiro went to another door. Peering through the grill was like looking into a black lacquer vase. The rattle of the door as he pulled it open brought the dog running to his heels, wagging his tail. Kojiro kicked the dog away, but to little effect. As he entered the building, the dog streaked in past him. The woman's screams were ear-splitting, the kind of screams that shatter glass. Then the dog started howling, and there was a battle of lung power between him and the shrieking woman. Kojiro wondered if the beams would split. Running forward, he discovered Akemi lying under the mosquito net and the monkey, which had jumped in the window to escape the dog, hiding behind her. Akemi was between the dog and the monkey, blocking the dog's way, so he attacked her. As she rolled to one side, the howl of the dog reached a crescendo. Akemi was now screaming from pain rather than fright. The dog had set his teeth around her forearm. Kojiro, with an oath, kicked him violently again in the ribs. The dog was already dead from the first kick, but even after the second, the teeth were solidly clamped on Akemi's arm.
"Let go! Let go!"
she screamed, writhing on the floor. Kojiro knelt beside her and pulled the dog's jaws open. The sound was like that of pieces of glued wood being wrenched apart. The mouth came open all right. A little more force on Kojiro's part, and the dog's head would have split in two. He threw the corpse out the door and came back to Akemi's side.
"It's all right now," he said soothingly,
but Akemi's forearm said otherwise. The blood flowing over the white skin gave the bite the appearance of a large crimson peony. Kojiro shivered at the sight.
"Isn't there any sake? I should wash it with sake. No, I guess there wouldn't be any in a place like this."
Warm blood flowed down the forearm to the wrist.
"I have to do something," he said, "or poison from the dog's teeth might cause you to go mad. He has been acting peculiarly these past few days."
While Kojiro tried to decide what could be done in a hurry, Akemi screwed her eyebrows together, bent her lovely white neck backward and cried,
"Mad? Oh, how wonderful! That's what I want to be, mad! Completely stark raving mad!"
"What's this?" stammered Kojiro. Without further ado, he bent over her forearm and sucked blood from the wound. When his mouth was full, he spat it out, put his mouth back to the white skin, and sucked until his cheeks bulged. In the evening, Tanzaimon returned from his daily round.
"I'm back, Akemi," he announced as he entered the temple. "Were you lonesome while I was gone?"
He deposited her medicine in a corner, along with the food and the jar of oil he had bought, and said,
"Wait a moment, I'll make some light."
When the candle was lit, he saw that she was not in the room.
"Akemi,"
he called.
Where could she have gone?
His one-sided love turned suddenly to anger, which was quickly replaced by loneliness. Tanzaimon was reminded, as he had been before, that he would never be young again, that there was no more honor, no more hope. He thought of his aging body and winced.
"I rescued her and took care of her," he grumbled, "and now she's gone off without a word. Is that the way the world is always going to be? Is that the way she is? Or was she still suspicious of my intentions?"
On the bed, he discovered a scrap of cloth, apparently torn from the end of her obi. The spot of blood on it rekindled his animal instincts. He kicked the straw matting into the air and threw the medicine out the window. Hungry, but lacking the will to prepare a meal, he took up his shakuhachi and, with a sigh, went out onto the veranda. For an hour or more, he played without stopping, attempting to expel his desires and delusions. Yet it was evident to him that his passions remained with him, and would remain with him until he died.
"She'd already been taken by another man," he mused. "Why did I have to be so moral and upright? There was no need for me to lie there alone, pining all night."
Half of him regretted not having acted. The other half condemned his lecherous yearning. It was precisely this conflict of emotions, swirling incessantly in his veins, that constituted what the Buddha called delusion. He was trying now to cleanse his impure nature, but the more he strived, the muddier the tone of his shakuhachi became. The beggar who slept beneath the temple poked his head from under the veranda.
"Why are you sitting there playing your recorder?" he asked. "Did something good happen? If you made lots of money and bought some sake, how about giving me a drink?"
He was a cripple, and from his lowly viewpoint, Tanzaemon lived like a king.
"Do you know what happened to the girl I brought home last night?"
"She was a nice-looking wench, wasn't she? If I'd been able, I wouldn't have let her get away. Not long after you left this morning, a young samurai with a long forelock and a huge sword on his back came and took her away. The monkey, too. He had one of them on one shoulder, one on the other."
"Samurai? Forelock?"
"Ugh, and what a handsome fellow he was. Handsomer by far than you and me."
The humor of this sent the beggar into a paroxysm of laughter.
The Announcement. Seijuro arrived back at the school in a foul mood. He thrust the falcon into a disciple's hands, curtly ordering him to put the bird back in its cage.
"Isn't Kojiro with you?" asked the disciple.
"No, but I'm sure he'll be along presently."
After changing his clothes, Seijuro went and sat down in the room where guests were received. Across the court was the great dojo, closed since the final practice on the 25th. Throughout the year, there was the coming and going of 1,000 or so students. Now, the dojo would not be open again until the first training session of the new year. With the wooden swords silent, the house seemed coldly desolate. Desperate to have Kojiro as a sparring partner, Seijuro inquired of the disciple repeatedly whether he had returned. But Kojiro did not come back, neither that evening nor the following day. Other callers came in force, however, it being the last day of the year, the day to settle up all accounts. For those in business, it was a question of collecting now or waiting until the Bon Festival of the following summer, and by noon, the front room was full of bill collectors. Normally, these men wore an air of complete subservience in the presence of samurai, but now, their patience exhausted, they were making their feelings known in no uncertain terms.
"Can't you pay at least part of what you owe?"
"You've been saying the man in charge is out, or the master is away, for months now. Do you think you can keep putting us off forever?"
"How many times do we have to come here?"
"The old master was a good customer. I wouldn't say a word if it were only the last half year, but you didn't pay at mid-year either. Why, I've even got unpaid bills from last year."
A couple of them impatiently tapped on their account books and stuck them under the nose of the disciple. There were carpenters, plasterers, the rice man, the sake dealer, clothiers, and sundry suppliers of everyday goods. Swelling their ranks were the proprietors of various tea houses where Seijuro ate and drank on credit. And these were the small fry, whose bills could hardly be compared to those of the usurers from whom Denshiro, unknown to his brother, had borrowed cash. Half a dozen of these men sat down and refused to budge.
"We want to talk with Master Seijuro himself. It's a waste of time to talk to disciples."
Seijuro kept to himself in the back of the house, his only words being,
"Tell them I'm out!"
And Denshiro, of course, would not have come near the house on a day like this. The face most conspicuously absent was that of the man in charge of the school's books and the household accounts, Gion Toji. Several days earlier, he had decamped with Oko and all the money he had collected on his trip west. Presently, six or seven men swaggered in, led by Ueda Ryohei, who even in such humiliating circumstances was swollen with pride at being one of the 10 swordsmen of the house of Yoshioka.
With a menacing look, he asked, "What's going on here?"
The disciple, while contriving to make it plain that he considered no explanation necessary, gave a brief rundown of the situation.
"Is that all?"
Ryohei said scornfully.
"Just a bunch of money grubbers? What difference does it make as long as the bills are eventually paid? Tell the ones who don't want to wait for payments to step into the practice hall. I'll discuss it with them in my own language."
In the face of this threat, the bill collectors grew sulky. Owing to Yoshioka Kempo's uprightness in money matters, not to mention his position as a military instructor to the Ashikaga shoguns, they had bowed before the Yoshioka household, groveled, lent them goods, lent them anything, come whenever summoned, left when they were told, and said yes to anything and everything. But there was a limit to how long they could kowtow to these vain warriors. The day they allowed themselves to be intimidated by threats like Ryohei's was the day the merchant class would go out of business, and without them, what would the samurai do? Did they imagine for a moment they could run things by themselves? As they stood around grumbling, Ryohei made it perfectly clear that he regarded them as so much dirt.
"All right now, go on home. Hanging around here won't do you any good."
The merchants grew silent, but made no move to leave.
"Throw them out!" cried Ryohei. "Sir, this is an outrage. What's outrageous about it?"
asked Ryohei.
"It's completely irresponsible. Who says it's irresponsible? But it is irresponsible to throw us out. Then why don't you leave quietly? We're busy."
"If it wasn't the last day of the year, we wouldn't be here begging. We need the money you owe to settle our own debts before the day is out."
"That's too bad. Too bad. Now go."
"This is no way to treat us."
"I think I've heard enough of your complaints."
Ryohei's voice grew angry again.
"No one would complain if you'd just pay up."
"Come here,"
commanded Ryohei.
"Who? Anyone who's dissatisfied."
"This is crazy."
"Who said that?"
"I wasn't referring to you, sir. I was talking about this situation."
"Shut up!"
Ryohei seized the man by his hair and threw him out the side door.
"Anybody else with complaints?"
growled Ryohei.
"We're not going to have you riffraff inside the house claiming paltry sums of money. I won't permit it. Even if the young master wants to pay you, I won't let him do it."
At the sight of Ryohei's fist, the bill collectors stumbled all over each other in their rush to get out of the gate. But once outside, their vilification of the house of Yoshioka intensified.
"Will I ever laugh and clap my hands when I see the for sale sign posted on this place? It shouldn't be long now."
"They say it won't be."
"How could it be?"
Ryohei, vastly amused, held his stomach with laughter as he went to the back of the house. The other disciples went with him to the room where Seijudo was bent, alone and silent, over the brazier.
"Young master," said Ryohei, "you're so quiet. Is something wrong?"
"Oh, no,"
replied Seijudo, somewhat cheered by the sight of his most trusted followers.
"The day's not far off now, is it?" he said.
"Nope,"
agreed Ryohei.
"That's what we came to see you about. Shouldn't we decide on the time and place and let Musashi know?"
"Why, yes, I suppose so,"
said Seijudo pensively.
"The place. Where would be a good place? How about the field at the Rendaiji, north of the city?"
"That sounds all right. What about the time?"
"Should it be before the New Year's decorations are taken down, or after?"
"The sooner the better. We don't want to give that coward time to worm his way out."
"How about the 8th?
"Isn't the 8th the anniversary of Master Kempo's death?"
"Ah, so it is. In that case, how about the 9th? At 7 o'clock in the morning?" "That'll do, won't it?"
"All right. We'll post a sign on the bridge this evening."
"Fine."
"Are you ready?"
asked Ryohei.
"I've been ready all along,"
replied Seijudo, who was in no position to answer otherwise. He had not really considered the possibility of losing to Musashi. Having studied under his father's tutelage since childhood, and having never lost a match to anyone in the school, not even to the oldest and best-trained disciples, He couldn't imagine being beaten by this young, inexperienced country bumpkin. His confidence, nonetheless, was not absolute. He felt a tinge of uncertainty, and characteristically, instead of attributing this to his failure to put into practice the way of the samurai, wrote it off as being due to recent personal difficulties. One of these, perhaps the greatest, was Akemi. He'd been ill at ease ever since the incident at Sumiyoshi, and when Gion Toji had absconded, he had learned that the financial cancer in the Yoshioka household had already reached a critical stage. Ryohei and the others came back with a message to Musashi written on a freshly cut board.
"Is this what you had in mind?" asked Ryohei.
The characters, still glistening wet, said,
"Answer. In response to your request for a bout, I name the following time and place. Place, field of the Rendaiji. Time, 7 o'clock in the morning, 9th day of the first month. I swear on my sacred oath to be present. If by some chance you do not fulfill your promise, I shall consider it my right to ridicule you in public. If I break this agreement, may the punishment of the gods be visited upon me. Seijuro Yoshioka Kenpo II of Kyoto. Done on the last day of 1605. To the Ronin of Mimasaka, Miyamoto Musashi." After reading it, Seijuro said,
"It's all right."
The announcement made him feel more relaxed, perhaps because for the first time it came home to him that the die was cast. At sunset, Ryohei put the sign under his arm and strode proudly along the street with a couple of other men to post it on the great bridge at Gojo Avenue. At the foot of Yoshida Hill, the man to whom the announcement was addressed was walking through a neighborhood of samurai of noble lineage and small means. Conservatively inclined, they led ordinary lives and were unlikely to be found doing anything that would excite comment. Musashi was going from gate to gate, examining the nameplates. Eventually, he came to a stop in the middle of the street, seemingly unwilling or unable to look further. He was searching for his aunt, his mother's sister, and his only living relative besides Ogin. His aunt's husband was a samurai serving, for a small stipend, the house of Konoe. Musashi thought it would be easy to find the house near Yoshida Hill, but soon discovered there was very little to distinguish one house from another. Most were small, surrounded by trees, and their gates were shut tight as clams. Quite a few of the gates had no nameplates. His uncertainty about the place he was seeking made him reluctant to ask directions. "They must have moved," he thought. "I may as well stop looking." He turned back toward the center of town, which lay under a mist, reflecting the lights of the year-end marketplace. Although it was New Year's Eve, the streets in the downtown area still hummed with activity. Musashi turned to look at a woman who had just passed, going the other way. He hadn't seen his aunt for at least 7 or 8 years, but he was sure this was she, for the woman resembled the image he had formed of his mother. He followed her a short distance, then called out to her. She stared at him suspiciously for a moment or two, intense surprise reflected in eyes wrinkled by years of humdrum living on a tiny budget.
"You're Musashi, Munisai's son, aren't you?" she finally asked.
He wondered why she called him Musashi rather than Takezo, but what actually disturbed him was the impression that he was not welcome.
"Yes," he replied, "I'm Takezo from the House of Shinmen."
She looked him over thoroughly, without the customary ohs and ahs as to how large he had grown or how different he'd looked from before.
"Why have you come here?"
she asked coolly in a rather censorious tone.
"I had no special purpose in coming. I just happened to be in Kyoto. I thought it would be nice to see you."
Looking at the eyes and hairline of his aunt, he thought of his mother. If she were still alive, surely she would be about as tall as this woman and speak with the same sort of voice.
"You came to see me?"
she asked incredulously.
"Yes, I'm sorry it's so sudden."
His aunt waved her hand before her face in a gesture of dismissal.
"Well, you've seen me, so there's no reason to go any farther. Please leave."
Abashed at this chilly reception, he blurted out, "Why do you say that as soon as you see me? If you want me to leave, I'll go, but I can't see why. Have I done something you disapprove of? If so, at least tell me what it is." His aunt seemed unwilling to be pinned down.
"Oh, as long as you're here, why don't you come to our house and say hello to your uncle? But you know what kind of person he is, so don't be disappointed at anything he might say. I'm your aunt, and since you've come to see us, I don't want you to go away with hard feelings."
Taking what little comfort he could from this, Musashi walked with her to her house and waited in the front room while she broke the news to her husband. Through the shoji, he could hear the asthmatic, grumbling voice of his uncle, whose name was Matsuo Kaname.
"What?"
asked Kaname testily.
"Munisai's son here? I was afraid he'd show up sooner or later. You mean he's here, in this house? You let him in without asking me?"
Enough was enough. But when Musashi called to his aunt to say goodbye, Kaname said,
"You're in there, are you?"
and slid the door open. His face wore not a frown, but an expression of utter contempt, the look city people reserve for their unwashed country relatives. It was as though a cow had lumbered in and planted its hooves on the tatami.
"Why did you come here?" asked Kaname.
"I happened to be in town. I thought I'd just ask after your health."
"That's not true."
"Sir?"
"You can lie all you want, but I know what you've done. You caused a lot of trouble in Mimasaka, made a lot of people hate you, disgraced your family's name, and then ran away. Isn't that the truth?"
Musashi was nonplussed.
"How can you be so shameless as to come to call on relatives?"
"I'm sorry for what I did," said Musashi, "but I fully intend to make the proper amends to my ancestors and to the village."
"I suppose you can't go back home, of course. Well, we reap what we sow. Munisai must be weeping in his grave."
"I've stayed too long," said Musashi. "I must be going now."
"Oh, no you don't," said Kaname angrily. "You stay right here. If you go wandering around this neighborhood, you'll get yourself in trouble in no time. That cantankerous old woman from the Hongiden family showed up here about a half year ago. Recently, she's been around several times. She keeps asking us whether you've been here and trying to find out from us where you are. She's after you, all right, with a terrible vengeance."
"Oh, Osugi. Has she been here?"
"Indeed she has. I heard all about you from her. If you weren't a relative of mine, I'd tie you up and hand you over to her. But under the circumstances... Anyway, you stay here for now. It'll be best to leave in the middle of the night, so there won't be any trouble for your aunt and me."
That his aunt and uncle had swallowed every word of Osugi's slander was mortifying. Feeling terribly alone, Musashi sat in silence, staring at the floor. Eventually, his aunt took pity on him and told him to go to another room and get some sleep. Musashi flopped down on the floor and loosened his scabbards. Once again came the feeling that he had no one in the world to depend on but himself. He reflected that perhaps his uncle and aunt were dealing with him frankly and sternly precisely because of the blood relationship. While he had been angry enough earlier to want to spit on the doorway and leave, he now took a more charitable view, reminding himself that it was important to give them the benefit of every doubt. He was too naive to accurately judge the people around him. If he had already become rich and famous, his sentiments about relatives would have been appropriate. But here he was barging in out of the cold in a dirty rag of a kimono on New Year's Eve of all times. Under the circumstances, his aunt and uncle's lack of familial affection was not surprising. This was soon brought forcefully home to Musashi. He had lain down hungry on the guileless assumption that he would be offered something to eat. Though he smelled food cooking and heard the rattle of pots and pans in the kitchen, No one came near his room, where the flicker of the fire in the brazier was no larger than that of a firefly. He presently concluded that hunger and cold were secondary. What was most important now was to get some sleep, which he proceeded to do. He awoke about 4 hours later to the sound of temple bells ringing out the old year. The sleep had done him good. Jumping to his feet, he felt that his fatigue had been washed away. His mind was fresh and clear. In and around the city, huge bells bonged in slow and stately rhythm, marking the end of darkness and the beginning of light. 108 peals for the 108 illusions of life, each ring a call to men and women to reflect on the vanity of their ways. Musashi wondered how many people there were who on this night could say, "I was right. I did what I should have done. I have no regrets." For him, each resounding knell evoked a tremor of remorse. He could conjure up nothing but the things he had done wrong during the last year. Nor was it only the last year. The year before, and the year before that, all the years that had gone by had brought regrets. There had not been a single year devoid of them. Indeed, there had hardly been one day. From his limited perspective of the world, it seemed that whatever people did, they soon came to regret. Men, for example, took wives with the intention of living out their lives with them, but often changed their minds later. One could readily forgive women for their afterthoughts, but then women rarely voiced their complaints, whereas men frequently did so. How many times had he heard men disparage their wives as if they were old discarded sandals? Musashi had no marital problems, to be sure, but he had been the victim of delusion, and remorse was not a feeling alien to him. At this very moment, he was very sorry he had come to his aunt's house. "Even now," he lamented, "I'm not free of my sense of dependence. I keep telling myself I must stand on my own 2 feet and fend for myself. Then I suddenly fall back on someone else. It's shallow. It's stupid." "I know what I should do," he thought. "I should make a resolution and write it down." He undid his shugyosha's pack and took out a notebook made of pieces of paper folded in quarters and tied together with coiled paper strips. He used this to jot down thoughts that occurred to him during his wanderings, along with Zen expressions, notes on geography, admonitions to himself, and, occasionally, crude sketches of interesting things he saw. Opening the notebook in front of him, he took up his brush and stared at the white sheet of paper. Musashi wrote, "I will have no regrets about anything." While he often wrote down resolutions, he found that merely writing them did little good. He had to repeat them to himself every morning and every evening as one would sacred scripture. Consequently, he always tried to choose words that were easy to remember and recite, like poems. He looked for a time at what he had written, then changed it to read, "I will have no regrets about my actions." He mumbled the words to himself, but still found them unsatisfactory. He changed them again. "I will do nothing that I will regret." Satisfied with this third effort, he put his brush down. Although the three sentences had been written with the same intent, the first two could conceivably mean he would have no regrets whether he acted rightly or wrongly, whereas the third emphasized his determination to act in such a way as to make self-reproach unnecessary. Musashi repeated the resolution to himself, realizing it was an ideal he could not achieve unless he disciplined his heart and his mind to the utmost of his ability. Nevertheless, to strive for a state in which nothing he did would cause regrets was the path he must pursue. "Someday I will reach that state," he vowed, driving the oath like a stake deep into his own heart. The shoji behind him slid open, and his aunt looked in. With a voice shivering around the roots of her teeth, she said, "I knew it!
Something told me I shouldn't let you stay here, and now what I was afraid would happen is happening. Osugi came knocking at the door and saw your sandals in the entrance hall. She's convinced you're here and insists we bring you to her. Listen, you can hear from here. Oh, Musashi, do something.
Osugi, here? Said Musashi, reluctant to believe his ears. But there was no mistake. He could hear her hoarse voice seeping through the cracks like an icy wind, addressing Kaname in her stiffest, haughtiest manner. Osugi had arrived just as the pealing of the midnight bells had ended, and Musashi's aunt was on the point of going to draw fresh water for the new year. Troubled by the thought of her new year being ruined by the unclean sight of blood, she made no attempt to hide her annoyance.
"Run away as fast as you can," she implored. "Your uncle's holding her off by insisting you haven't been here. Slip out now while there's still time."
She picked up his hat and pack and led him to the back door, where she had placed a pair of her husband's leather socks along with some straw sandals. While tying the sandals, Musashi said sheepishly, "I hate to be a nuisance, but won't you give me a bowl of gruel? I haven't had a thing to eat this evening."
"This is no time for eating, but here, take these, and be off with you."
She held out 5 rice cakes on a piece of white paper. Eagerly accepting them, Musashi held them up to his forehead in a gesture of thanks. "Goodbye," he said. On his way down the icy lane, on the first day of the joyous new year, Musashi walked sadly. A winter bird with feathers molted, flying off into a black sky. His hair and fingernails felt frozen. All he could see was his own white breath, quickly turning to frost on the fine hairs around his mouth.
"It's cold," he said out loud.
Surely the 8 freezing hells could not be this numbing. Why, when he normally shrugged off the cold, did he feel it so bitterly this morning? He answered his own question. "It's not just my body. I'm cold inside. Not disciplined properly, that's what it is. I still long to cling to warm flesh like a baby, and I give in too quickly to sentimentality. Because I'm alone, I feel sorry for myself and envy people who have nice warm houses. At heart, I'm base and mean. Why can't I be thankful for independence and freedom to go where I choose? Why can't I hold on to my ideals and my pride?" As he savored the advantages of freedom, his aching feet grew warm, down to the tips of his toes, and his breath turned to steam. A wanderer with no ideal, no sense of gratitude for his independence, is no more than a beggar. The difference between a beggar and the great wandering priest Saigyo lies inside the heart. He suddenly became aware of a white sparkle under his feet. He was treading on brittle ice. Without noticing, he had walked all the way to the frozen edge of the Kamo River. Both it and the sky were still black, and there was as yet no hint of dawn in the east. His feet stopped. Somehow, they had carried him without mishap through the darkness from Yoshida Hill, but now they were reluctant to go on. In the shadow of the dike, he gathered together twigs, chips of wood, and anything else that would burn, then began scratching at his flint. The raising of the first tiny flame required work and patience, but eventually some dry leaves caught. With the care of a woodworker, he began piling on sticks and small branches. After a certain point, the fire rapidly took on life, and as it drew the wind, it fanned out toward its maker, ready to scorch his face. Musashi took the rice cakes his aunt had given him and toasted them one by one in the flames. They turned brown and swelled up like bubbles, reminding him of the New Year celebrations of his childhood. The rice cakes had no flavor but their own. They were neither salted nor sweetened. Chewing them, he thought of the taste of the plain rice as the taste of the real world about him. "I'm having my own New Year celebration," he thought happily. As he warmed his face by the flames and stuffed his mouth, the whole thing began to seem rather amusing. It's a good New Year's celebration. If even a wanderer like me has 5 good rice cakes, then it must be that heaven allows everybody to celebrate the New Year one way or another. I have the Kamo River to toast the New Year with, and the 36 peaks of Higashiyama are my pine tree decorations. I must cleanse my body and wait for the first sunrise. At the edge of the icy river, he untied his obi and removed his kimono and underwear. Then he plunged in and, splashing about like a water bird, washed himself thoroughly. He was standing on the bank, wiping his skin vigorously, when the first rays of dawn broke through a cloud and fell warmly on his back. He looked toward the fire and saw someone standing on the dike above it, another traveler, different in age and appearance, brought here by fate. Osugi. The old woman had seen him too, and cried out in her heart, "He's here! The troublemaker is here!" Overcome by joy and fear, she nearly fell down in a swoon. She wanted to call to him, but her voice choked. Her trembling body would not do as it was told. Abruptly, she sat down in the shadow of a small pine. "At last," she rejoiced, "I've finally found him. Uncle Gon's spirit has led me to him." In the bag hanging from her waist, she was carrying a fragment of Uncle Gon's bones and a lock of his hair. Each day since his death, she'd talk to the dead man. "Uncle Gon," she'd say, "even though you're gone, I don't feel alone. You stayed with me when I vowed not to go back to the village without punishing Musashi and Otsu. You're with me still. You may be dead, but your spirit is always beside me. We're together forever. Look up through the grass at me and watch. I'll never let Musashi go unpunished." To be sure, Uncle Gon had been dead only a week, but Osugi was resolved to keep faith with him until she, too, was reduced to ashes. In the past few days, she had pressed her search with the furor of the terrible Kishimojin, who, before her conversation by the Buddha, had killed other children to feed to her own, said to have numbered 500, or 1,000, or 10,000. Osugi's first real clue had been a rumor she'd heard in the street that there was soon to be a bout between Musashi and Yoshioka Seijuro. Then, early the previous evening, she had been among the onlookers who watched the sign being posted on the great bridge at Gojo Avenue. How that had excited her. She had read it through time and time again, thinking, "So Musashi's ambition has finally got the better of him. They'll make a clown of him. Yoshioka will kill him. Oh, if that happens, how will I be able to face the people at home? I swore I myself would kill him. I must get to him before Yoshioka does. And take that sniveling face back and hold it up by the hair for the villagers to see." Then she had prayed to the gods, to the bodhisattvas, and to her ancestors for help. For all her fury and all her venom, she had come away from the Matsuo house disappointed. Returning along the Kamo River, she had first taken the firelight to be a beggar's bonfire. For no particular reason, she had stopped on the dike and waited. When she caught sight of the muscular naked man emerging from the river, oblivious of the cold, she knew it was Musashi. Since he had no clothes on, it would be a perfect time to catch him by surprise and cut him down, but even her old, dried-up heart would not let her do that. She put her palms together and offered a prayer of thanks, just as she would if she had already taken Musashi's head. "How happy I am! Thanks to the favor of the gods and bodhisattvas, I have Musashi before my eyes. It couldn't be mere chance. My constant faith has been rewarded. My enemy has been delivered into my hands." She bowed before heaven, firm in her belief that she now had all the time in the world to complete her mission. The rocks along the water's edge seemed to float above the ground one by one as the light struck them. Musashi put on his kimono, tied his obi tightly, and girded on his 2 swords. he knelt on hands and knees and bowed silently to the gods of heaven and earth.
Osugi's heart leaped as she whispered, "Now!"
At that precise moment, Musashi sprang to his feet. Jumping nimbly over a pool of water, he started walking briskly along the river's edge. Osugi, taking care not to alert him to her presence, hurried along the dike. The roofs and bridges of the city began to form gentle white outlines in the morning mist, but above, stars still hovered in the sky, and the area along the foot of Higashiyama was as black as ink. When Musashi reached the wooden bridge at Sanjo Avenue, he went under it and reappeared at the top of the dike beyond, taking long, manly strides. Several times, Osugi came close to calling him, but checked herself. Musashi knew she was behind him, but he also knew that if he turned around, she would come storming at him, and he'd be forced to reward her effort with some show of defense, while at the same time not hurting her. A frightening opponent, he thought. If he were still Takezo, back in the village, he would have thought nothing of knocking her down and beating her until she spat blood, but of course he could no longer do that. In reality, he had more right to hate her than she him, but he wanted to make her see that her feeling toward him was based on a horrible misunderstanding. He was sure that if he could just explain things to her, she would cease regarding him as her eternal enemy. But since she'd carried her festering grudge for so many years, there was no likelihood that he himself could convince her now, not if he explained 1,000 times. There was only one possibility. Stubborn though she was, she would certainly believe Matahachi. If her own son told her exactly what had happened before and after Sekigahara, she could no longer consider Musashi an enemy of the Honiden family, let alone the abductor of her son's bride. He was drawing near the bridge, which was in an area that had flourished in the late 12th century, when the Taira family was at the peak of its fortunes. Even after the wars of the 15th century, it had remained one of the most populous sections of Kyoto. The sun was just beginning to reach the house fronts and gardens, where broom marks from the previous night's thorough sweeping were still visible, but at this early hour, not a door was open. Osugi could make out his footprints in the dirt. Even these she despised. Another 100 yards, then 50.
"Musashi!"
screamed the old woman. Balling her hands into fists, she thrust her head forward and ran toward him.
"You evil devil!" she shouted. "Don't you have ears?"
Musashi did not look back. Osugi ran on. Old as she was, her death-defying determination lent her footsteps a brave and masculine cadence. Musashi kept his back to her, casting about feverishly in his mind for a plan of action. All at once, she sprang in front of him, screaming,
"Stop!"
Her pointed shoulders and thin, emaciated ribs trembled. She stood there a moment, catching her breath and gathering spit in her mouth. Not concealing a look of resignation, Musashi said as nonchalantly as he could, "Well, if it isn't the Honiden Dowager, what are you doing here?"
"You insolent dog! Why shouldn't I be here? I'm the one who should ask you that. I let you get away from me on Sunnen Hill, but today I'll have that head of yours."
Her scrawny neck suggested a game rooster, and her shrill voice, which seemed set to whisk her protruding teeth out of her mouth, was more frightening to him than a battle cry. Musashi's dread of the old woman had its roots in reminiscences from his childhood days, the times when Osugi had caught him and Matahachi engaged in some mischief in the mulberry patch or the Honiden kitchen. He had been 8 or 9, just the age when the two of them were always up to something, and he still remembered clearly how Osugi had shouted at them. He had fled in terror, his stomach turning somersaults, and those memories made him shiver. He had regarded her then as a hateful, ill-tempered old witch, and even now he resented her betrayal of him when he returned to the village after Sekigahara. Curiously,
He had also grown accustomed to thinking of her as one person he could never get the best of. Still, with the passage of time, his feelings toward her had mellowed.
With Osugi, it was quite the opposite. She could not rid herself of the image of Takezo, the obnoxious and unruly little brat she had known since he was a baby, the boy with the runny nose and sores on his head, his arms and legs so long that he looked deformed. Not that she was unconscious of the passage of time. She was old now, she knew that. And Musashi was grown. But she could not overcome the urge to treat him as a vicious urchin. When she thought of how this little boy had shamed her, revenge. It was not only a matter of vindicating herself before the village, she had to see Musashi in his grave before she ended up in her own.
"There's no need for talk," she screeched. "Either give me your head or prepare to feel my blade. Get ready, Musashi."
She wiped her lips with her fingers, spat on her left hand, and grabbed her scabbard. There was a proverb about a praying mantis attacking the imperial carriage. Surely it must have been invented to describe the cadaverous Osugi with her spindly legs attacking Musashi. She looked exactly like a mantis. Her eyes, her skin, her absurd stance were all the same. And as Musashi stood on guard, watching her approach as he might a child at play, his shoulders and chest gave him the invincibility of a sturdy iron carriage. In spite of the incongruity of the situation, he was unable to laugh, for he was suddenly filled with pity.
"Come now, Granny, wait," he begged, grabbing her elbow lightly but firmly.
What are you doing?"
she cried. Both her powerless arm and her teeth shook with surprise.
"Coward!"
she stammered.
"You think you can talk me out of this? Well, I've seen 40 more New Years than you, and you can't trick me. Take your punishment."
Osugi's skin was the color of red clay, her voice filled with desperation. Musashi, nodding vigorously, said, "I understand. I know how you feel. You've got the fighting spirit of the Hongiden family in you, all right? I can see you have the same blood as the first of the Hongidens, the one who served so bravely under Shinmen Munetsura."
"Let go of me, you! I'm not going to listen to flattery from somebody young enough to be my grandchild."
"Calm down. It doesn't become an old person like you to be rash. I have something to say to you."
"Your last statement before you meet your death?"
"No, I want to explain."
"I don't want any explanations from you."
The old woman drew herself up to her full height. "Well then, I'll just have to take that sword away from you. Then when Matahachi shows up, he can explain everything to you."
"Matahachi?"
"Yes, I sent him a message last spring."
"Oh, you did, did you?"
"I told him to meet me here on New Year's morning."
"That's a lie!"
shrieked Osugi, vigorously shaking her head.
"You should be ashamed, Musashi. Aren't you Munisai's son? Didn't he teach you that when the time comes to die, you should die like a man? This is no time for playing around with words. My whole life is behind this sword, and I have the support of the gods and bodhisattvas. If you dare face it, face it."
She wrested her arm away from him and cried,
"Hail to the Buddha!"
Unsheathing her sword and grasping it with both hands, she lunged at his chest. He dodged.
"Calm down, Granny, please."
When he tapped her lightly on the back, she screamed and whirled around to face him. As she prepared to charge, she invoked the name of Kannong.
"Praise to Kannong Bosatsu! Praise to Kannon Bosatsu!"
She attacked again. As she passed him, Musashi seized her wrist. "You'll just wear yourself out carrying on like that. Look, the bridge is just over there. Come with me that far." Turning her head back over her shoulder, Osugi bared her teeth and pursed her lips.
"Phooey!"
she spat with all the breath she had left. Musashi let go of her and moved aside, rubbing his left eye with his hand. The eye burned as if a spark had struck it. He looked at the hand he had put to his eye. There was no blood on it, but he couldn't open the eye. Osugi, seeing he was off guard, charged with renewed strength, calling again on the name of Kannon. Twice, three times, she swung at him. On the third swing, preoccupied with his eye, he merely bent his body